program or for any sort of information that you would require from us. We can be contacted at 3273 Montagu Street, Regina. For more information about our program or for any sort of information that you would require from us. We can be contacted at 3273 Montagu Street, Regina, Islamic Association of Saskatchewan, Tahfizul Quran Academy. Our phone number is 306-585-0090. You can also contact Sheikh Elias directly at 306-591-5444. You can also go online and come to our website and look at the information about our academy and our Islamic Association at www.tahfizulquran.com. TAHFEEZQURAN.com. Jazakallah khair once again for coming and listening to us. We will see you next Monday, 6:30 on 91.3 FM CJTR.
Meet the CEO of Global Airlines.
Mom, what's for lunch?
Okay, Sean's not a business executive yet, but we're working on it. Sean's mom has added to her job earnings with the Saskatchewan Employment Supplement. That's good for Sean and for everyone. We're Saskatchewan Community Resources and Employment. We're working with Saskatchewan people who are building their independence through better jobs, better housing, and better incomes. Saskatchewan Community Resources and Employment. For more information, call us at 1-877-6-WORKING.
91.3 FM CJTR, Regina Community Radio, thanks for their generous support. The Regina and District Labor Council and its affiliates, working in the community to improve the lives of its members and the disadvantaged. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily shared by Radius Communications Incorporated, operators of 91.3 FM CJTR.
When you're growing up in a small town, when you're growing up in a small town, when you're growing up in a small town.
Well, it's Wednesday morning, which I guess it means it's time for Untitled, your weekly intervention view, what have you, into art exhibitions that are happening around Regina. As usual, I'm your host, Felipe Diaz, and joining me is Margaret Posada. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning, Phil. How are you today?
A little tired, but okay.
It's one of those tired gray days.
Yeah, you know, I really just wanted to stay in bed again, but nonetheless, I had to get up to be here to do this, so here we
well,
are.
Well, I'm really pleased that you're here.
That's good.
And on a strange note, the show I'd like to talk about today has a lot of that sort of neutral gray color in it.
I guess that is a good, an interesting connection. What are we talking about today?
We are talking about an exhibition of art that we're quite lucky to get into town. It's called Contained, and it's by Lisa Streifler, and it's up at Neutral Ground, which is the artist-run center on Scarf Street Mall. And I was happy to go to Lisa's opening, where she and Don Nosted had a conversation about her artwork last Saturday, but the artwork is up until October the 11th, so there's plenty of time to go down to Neutral Ground. I think they're open Tuesday through Saturday, about 11 to 5 each day. So if you've got a lunch time and you know you want to just wander up and take a look, it's really neat. She's got about 35 photographs, they're called, that are hanging up, and most of them are, it looks like a black and white drawing on a black outline, and then there's a wide border of this neutral gray, then a little thin white border, and then a black frame. And then there's a couple pictures in the back of the gallery wall, which are just huge, and they're kind of broken up into like one drawing or photograph would actually be framed in four pieces but shoved together, so it looks like a triptych, or I don't know, what would you call a four picture tick?
A tetric.
Tetric. There we go, tetric. But it's really slick-looking work. And when you get up close and you look at it, you see this really rough, quick drawing inside each of the silhouettes. And it's kind of interesting to hear about how Lisa did this as a process, because it's so shiny and photographic, and yet there's this immediacy with the drawing that's quite... I'm just doodling in the air in front of Phil, trying to explain the calligraphic qualities and the little bits of wash and stuff that Lisa's got. But I guess I should talk about the silhouettes for a second, and then just continue a bit about process, and then we should talk about content. So when Lisa talked about how she made the work, she had a studio assistant pick out a bunch of silhouettes, and she picked, I think, three main shapes. One was a house shape, one was a bunny rabbit shape, or she's got the bunnies in different poses, but it's basically a bunny rabbit shape, sitting or standing. And then a couple different, I think when you look at them, you think of pinups. So it's like 1950s or 1930s sort of coy woman pose, but you can't really tell what it is because it's just all blacked out. So her studio assistant blacked these out, and then she put a transparency on top of the silhouettes, and she just drew with non-permanent markers on top of these silhouettes to sort of make something up for the inside of the silhouette. And then I guess from there she scanned everything into the computer, and then was able to play with the different background colors, and she came up with this really neutral gray. And once she had figured that out, she could basically just print it off as a photograph from the computer, and she could go any size that she wanted. So that's why, even though they're like a drawing work, they're actually like a photograph, and they're reproducible. So she can do them in editions, the same way a photographer would their prints.
Okay. That sounds good. So yeah, I think the main thrust of all that is what we're looking at are silhouettes of particular icons, and then she, using some sort of like X-ray vision, she has envisioned into each silhouette another figure that responds to the initial image.
Yeah, like a black and white skeleton.
Yeah.
To the black iconic silhouette. And we say iconic because these are really recognizable as a rabbit or a house or a pinup girl.
Right. Yeah. There's no mistaking where they come from or what they're meant to represent.
Yeah. I mean, she talked about the different animals that she was interested in, and she thought, well, she has no relationship to horses and they're a nice shape, but like there's no personal meaning for her there. But she has a quite personal relationship with her dog, but she didn't think that other people would respond to it. So she settled on the rabbit as being something that she could respond to, but that other people would as well.
Right.
So I think she's really wanting people to understand the silhouette straight off.
Right. Yeah. And well, you know, again, they're straightforward, iconic images. You can't mistake them for anything else. But it's funny, like that. This show is a lot about dualities, and it's a lot about binaries in terms of what you're looking at. So like the silhouette gives you one sort of idea, which is like the pinup girl. And then the drawing that she's done on the inside, in white, like is a response to that image, but it's sort of like its antithesis at the same time. So like you have the voluptuous woman in the silhouette, and then on the inside you have like the anxiety-driven skeleton.
Yeah, and she talked about how, especially inside the women, like they're all deliberately ugly pieces, because as a feminist, she's kind of, you know, trying to let people know that the pinup isn't all that women are.
Yeah, but even more so, I think that she's and like judging from the work in her past as well, I mean, that there's a lot that has to do with her own self-image. And
by that, you're referencing the Normal Show, where she took images of herself and drew on top of them.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of anxiety there about the way women are supposed to be and then the way that they really are. And so that's the binary that she's sort of playing with through this. And it's funny, I mean, she's reflected that a bit in terms of the medium as well, like the blackened out silhouette on photographic paper is very slick and polished looking, and you know,
kind of like a slick magazine ad would be
exactly,
giving you,
yeah,
like, and your, then, the fall silhouette of what you're supposed to aspire to,
right,
fashion wise.
But then she's drawn on top of it. Like first she's whited out areas using like whiteout, which is not a very precise medium, and then you know she's used these markers to make these sort of sketchy looking drawings. But I think that sort of empowers them a bit more, because by making them a little rougher or a little less polished in form, you know, we can get to the idea that people are not that polished. People are not that finished as like the glossy magazine or the pinup would have us would suggest. You know, it's you know, we're talking again about the ideal and then the reality of life, right?
Yeah, and one of the pinups actually has an abstraction inside, which I thought was really interesting. Like it's just a texture. And that when you're talking about people not being really finished and stuff, like if you flip through a magazine and you look at a glossy ad or something, mm-hmm. you'd be quite, you wouldn't really think about the interior of that woman. Like you'd be thinking about the clothes she's wearing. And so just by having the abstraction inside, it's like almost like a textured emotion or something like
right,
that.
Right. And so, you know, just getting you to or getting the viewer at any rate to focus on that idea, you know, is already like an immense chore in and of itself. But nonetheless, there it is. It's like, you know, what we have inside of us and what we project on the outside are two different things. And they are responding to a bunch of different ideas about what we think people should be like.
Yeah, I was actually quite shocked when I saw the house pieces. They're just kind of on the wall when you first walk into the gallery. They're to your right. They're all along that wall. Mm-hmm. It's a silhouette of a house, and then there's a lot of like action taking place inside the houses, like men and women and arguing and fighting and like just really violent stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm trying to aspire to a happy home myself. So, and I know Lisa personally, and she's a really lovely person, and her partner's really nice, and they're going to adopt a kid pretty soon. And I thought, well, where's this coming from? Like, where's all this violence? You know, like, is that like a TV violence thing that's being reflected, which would be a little bit poor, mm-hmm. you know, for an artist to do, I think, because right. I always respect artwork that comes from the artist
right,
a bit more
right.
than, you know, just reflecting something from the media, although
right.
I guess that has its place too. But it wasn't until she started talking about where her art comes from that she said for a long time when she just got out of art school and she was in New York and when she moved back to Saskatchewan, her artwork came from a place of anger. And she said now, like the last 10 years, her artwork's coming from, and of course you've already used this word, a place of anxiety. And so I thought, well, maybe this isn't what's actually happening in the house, but maybe this is stuff that she fears happens. You know,
yeah.
And your fears can be a lot more violent and strong than your life is.
Absolutely. Well, and again, you know, it's the same thing, but played out in a different field, right? Like we can think about the idea of the home as being, you know, or the ideal of the home as domestic bliss, right? As sort of like that's what we're sold on a day-to-day basis, is that, you know, within our home, everyone is happy and blah blah blah, and you know.
As long as your lino is shiny.
Exactly. You know, like, you know, the vacuum cleaner is the best thing that happened to us, and we're so happy because we have it, kind of idealized space. When really what happens inside of homes is like there are times when things are really really going well, and then there are times of conflict, right? And it's and those times of conflict, I'm sure, cause a lot of anxiety in the way that we try to deal with them, and particularly if we're constantly striving for this ideal of domestic bliss, you know, where again, you know, like, you know, living with someone is not the easiest thing in the world, but we do it nonetheless because, you know, there are pleasures to be had out of that. But at the same time, you know, it comes with all this other baggage and all this conflict that we have to deal with it in some way, in some form.
Yeah, I don't know where the quote comes from, and I've been racking my brain. Something about marriage is hard work. You can see why the context for that would be really interesting. I think it was something about like the happily ever afters, you
right.
know, that where's the real story?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Like happily ever after never happens.
Right? Yeah, I know, but this is a personal failing of mine. I am not a good writer because I don't like conflict. I like my characters to be happy. I like them to go out for coffee and have some fun. And whenever I read stories that other people write and the characters undergo great hardship, I'm always like shocked and appalled for the characters and really will them towards a happier chapter.
Yeah.
And Gerald's like, there's no story without a conflict. You know, you can't just have your characters wandering around shopping.
I'm going to do something really cheesy and make reference to The Matrix now as a film. And what I was thinking about that is that in some point, you know, one of the agents has got one of the characters trapped. And he's talking about the first Matrix that they developed as this perfect utopian society, right? In which, you know, the ideals of domestic bliss we were
totally
satisfied.
Okay, so the Matrix is a large computer that has all human beings linked up into it, and the humans believe that they're living life, but in fact they're all having a consensual computer reality fantasy game.
Yeah, it's just like a complex virtual reality.
There we go.
Okay.
So the first complex virtual reality was a utopia.
Was a utopia. It was an ideal, right? And that everyone sort of lived in this idea. But then the human mind would not accept that ideal, right? That's his argument as to why they had to go to this other model, right?
Which is, you know, New York, 1999.
Right, which is filled with all sorts of conflict and, you know, aggression.
And bad plumbing.
And yeah, like things are not happening right the way they should. But somehow that seems to be more in line with the human experience. You know, again, you know, there's this binary that's sort of positioned before us where we have the idealized world and we have the reality of the world, and somewhere in between we have to negotiate our existence, and we have to sort of balance on the one hand our desires and our wants for this idealized space against sort of the reality of what we have to actually live with, right? And so you know, that's what he's saying in that sort of argument about, you know, trying to make a utopia for the citizens so that everyone could be happy and blah, 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 and it not working.
It's like trying to fit an elephant into a house.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And that brings us back to Lisa's drawings, where she's got the sad elephant sitting inside the house.
That's a curious piece, because I was really wondering about that one and where that one came from. And again, this one, like...
And the elephant doesn't even fit inside the house.
No, the elephant doesn't.
He's, like, breaking outside the silhouette borders.
Yeah, and...
And then, so Lisa, my partner Gerald asked Lisa, well, because my little boy and my partner were at the opening, too, and William really liked the elephants. He likes elephants in general. And they said, well, Lisa, like, we like the elephant. And Lisa's, what? There's no elephant. Oh yeah, over there. So I don't know. I never really heard why she drew the elephant or where it came from. But I think her drawing style is so quick and so fast that she's drawing a lot and really fast. And so the elephant is coming from what, like her subconscious?
Okay, so we have 2 points there to talk about if we can want to get into it. The first one was, if I understand this correctly, you're arguing that there's like a surrealistic aspect to Lisa's work, and that somehow she's letting the unconscious fly through her hand without thinking about it.
I'm coming to that as I'm saying it, but I think you said it much better.
Okay, so that
would you agree with me, though? Like, she really values that quickness.
She does. I agree. I would agree with that, and that she values the quickness. I don't know how much of the unconscious is coming through in her work. I think she's very conscious about what she's doing and the issues that she wants to address.
Well, yeah, but I think she edits after. Like, I think she draws first and then edits.
Well, again, but the whole idea of editing would be against that sort of voice of the unconscious, because the unconscious voice is unedited.
Right, but I think artistic practice is such that you have to do both, right? You have to make the artwork without over-intellectualizing it, and then once it's done, you can look at it and go, is this going where it should be, and kind of edit it.
I guess it depends on how hardcore surrealist you really want to be, because like in the traditional way of doing it, right, like the...
Well, first you have to grow a mustache and wax it.
No, I was thinking about the exquisite corpse.
Oh, right, where you just... Well, explain the exquisite corpse.
Okay, so it was originally a literary surrealist parlor game, and what would happen is that you'd take a piece of paper and you'd fold it up into...
accordion pleats.
Yeah, accordion pleats. And then someone would write something on the first pleat, and then they'd flip it over, and then you'd you'd get it, and then you'd have to write something underneath, not knowing what was written above it, and not knowing what will be written below. And then finally, at the end, the whole thing is unfolded, and they read the whole
text. And the laughs ensue.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a cute little parlor game, but, I mean, the idea was that, again, it was is a way of allowing the unconscious of the participants to just flow out and not think about what they're doing, but just sort of express it.
Well, I would argue it kind of defeats the ability to edit. And what you just described is like the default.
Yeah.
You know, like it was one of their ways of trying to get rid of the critical
eye. Right. But that's like the conscious mind is the editing mind, right? So when you get rid of that, then
you free the subconscious to say something.
You can free the unconscious.
It works better with the drawing, right? Because you would see the end points of where the lines come from.
Yeah. And
so you would start from the end point and draw whatever you're going to draw and then leave a little bit for the next person to see.
And it's quite interesting, the results that come out. You know, I think everyone should try doing that at least once in their life. But that was sort of one point with the elephant. Like, I don't know if I would position her work within a surrealist practice, but elements of that seem to be coming out.
Well, I mean, how could they not, right? If you're sitting down with these silhouettes and you're just drawing, and the drawings are really fast, you know, and you're just really open to, and she talks about how, like, she doesn't want to sit down with, like, precious materials. Like, she's not going to sit down in front of, like, a $40 piece of canvas and carefully varnish it and draw, like, a little thing and then put a couple brush strokes of egg tempera down. And, like, these aren't really precious materials, and it's not really, she's not interested in time-consuming work. And it was funny that she was in conversation with John Nostaden, who's all about very, very precise time-consuming work. And she's saying, John, you and I are so opposite, you know, in the way we work, and yet they're great friends. So I think that's why they're talking. But, you know, I think as a result of her style, like, she's got to be accessing stuff like that, the unconscious. I mean,
maybe.
All right. My vocabulary is just a large featureless gray expanse.
I don't know if she's accessing the unconscious or not. I mean, like, obviously we can't go into Lisa's mind and find that out for sure. I think that she's inundated herself with texts around this material, and she's expressing those texts back out in a very visual way, which is very effective. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if the unconscious is coming through in that particular way. I think that she just by trying to iterate the idea of our ideals versus our reality of existence and where we try to situate ourselves between us, I think already we have like an immense field worth plumbing, you know, without sort of trying to figure out if it's unconscious or not. But
well, John asked her if she's interested in cute, right? Because the bunny's there, right? And bunnies always make you think about that. And she said, well, she likes the bunny as a shape. And she like, you know, no matter how you cast the bunny, whether in chocolate or in, you know, she said that.
Chocolate bunny.
She likes the shape, but she's not interested in cuteness.
Right.
But what she is interested in is vulnerability.
Right. Yeah. And that for me makes a lot of sense again.
You know, and she talked about how the rabbit is like one of those things that everybody eats.
Yes.
You know, the coyote, the...
A brace of conies.
Okay, so Phil eats rabbits as well. But yeah, that they're always on the constant watch because they're so vulnerable as a herbivore. They're pretty pivotal in the food chain. So, you know, she's interested in the vulnerability of the rabbits.
But it's sort of like an idealized projection of what we think rabbits are.
Well, they're not particularly sweet. I mean, if you get to know a rabbit, they can be quite strong. And if you're trying to hold one against its will, it could give you, I'm just ripping open my shirt here to show Phil my childhood scar from the rabbit that got away.
Well, but my point exactly, right, is that they're like any other wild animal, right? And that they, you know, they have aggression and they try to defend themselves, you know, if put into the situation where they need to defend themselves. And they're not, right now I'm having like images of Thumper, you know, playing with Bambi on the ice, you know, and they're sort of sweet and sliding around and blah, blah, blah. But the reality...
The real rabbit isn't the Disney cartoon.
No, and in fact, it's quite a different animal in terms of the way that it reacts. And so, you know, I think that...
But we're just getting back to the same polarity, right? The pinup girl is
well,
not...
Yeah. But that's it's all about, for me, making links between the works, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And so that for me is that that polarity, that binary seems to come up again and again and again within the work. You know, you can talk about the images of the houses, the pinup girls, or the rabbits. They're all sort of dealing with the same kind of notion and bringing it back again. As our ideals and our expectations of a thing and the reality of it are two totally different things. But somewhere in between, we navigate that. And it's our anxieties about that Lisa's talking about, like that navigation can be very difficult and can be very frustrating for a lot of people. And it's how we deal with that is what is being expressed here.
I think that's a really important point, because I think a lot of times people go into the gallery and they maybe want to shop for their couch, you know, and I don't think I could live with Lisa's work over my couch, right? It's just not peaceful in that way. Except for maybe the elephant house. That's really fun.
It's a sad elephant, though. It's crying. Like it's.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not the happiest.
There is actually
elephant.
A bunny with some sweet little kid characters inside of it, and that's quite fun, too, in a whimsical way.
Yeah.
But the rest of her work is all about the anxiety. And.
Well, I've lived with a Streifler work in my house for a while now.
Does it give you bad dreams?
No, I'm okay. It's small. I keep it sort of
it's small
on the side there.
That was from the Normal Show, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The Normal Show was really small artworks in little frames.
Yeah.
And these are quite large. And I liked that because there's something fun about the change in scale.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole process of transferring the little tiny drawings into the computer and then being able to blow them up huge like a photograph, and then you can really appreciate the sort of ephemeral qualities of the brush and the pen that she's got. I just love that whole scale thing.
Right, you know. And again, you know, for me, that just falls right back into the whole debate that we're having about binaries and stuff. You
know, again, the small and the large. Yeah.
Yeah, the small and the large, you know, the hand done versus the computer finish, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, all those differences are operant within our day-to-day reality. And somehow we have to balance them. We negotiate them.
Excellent.
Just coming back and again and again to those sorts of things. But there was another point that I had, which has totally slipped my mind when I said that brings up two things. We only argued about one, or we only discussed one.
Shiny, happy rabbits, trips to Disneyland, things in plexiglass cubes, self-portraits, William loves elephants.
It's all out there now, and I just can't remember what it is. So I guess we'll just move on from it. But again...
So once again, we're talking about Lisa Streifler's work,
mm-hmm.
and this was just programmed quite recently into the Neutral Ground Gallery, the Scar Street Mall artist-run center, and the work is called Contained, and I think that's quite explanatory, right? You've got these iconic images and the stuff that's contained inside from September 13th to October 11th. And I think there's an essay on the internet if you want to follow up on it.
Yeah, and there's also a little catalog available at the gallery as well.
Which has more writing in it, absolutely.
Yeah.
So there's some neat stuff coming up in the Mackenzie this week as well.
Well, you know, like I mentioned last week, for a long time there, you know, the summer is a dry and long time when not
a dry,
much
hot experience.
And then in September, much like these cloud bursts that we're getting now, everything sort of starts to happen all over again. So, yes, we have,
we have
a lot of things happening.
Friday night at the Saskatchewan Film Pool Cooperative, which is also on Scar Street Mall, they're having an exhibition of James Benning's recent work. I think it's something from 1992. And I'm just going to read a quote on it. To make this film, Benning had to make the same trip twice. To watch it even once is to be distracted, but in an evocative and resonant manner. To be drawn away from Benning's travels and alienations, reminded of one's own. I don't know what to expect. James Benning is well respected within the experimental film world.
Right.
And this film is 87 minutes long. It's at 9 o'clock at the Saskatchewan Film Pool. If you want to find out more, their phone number is 757-8818. I've seen some of Benning's work, but his earlier stuff, and I don't know, it could be really interesting.
Okay.
And the Mackenzie Art Gallery has an opening on September the 20th, which is Saturday night. Yeah, actually, The opening is Friday night at 7:30 at the Mackenzie Art Gallery. They have an artist discussion on Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And the exhibition's called That's My Wonderful Town. And apparently that's a quote from a 1960s jingle that was written by Carol Gay Bell describing Regina. That's my wonderful town. Now, her son Brett has actually made a film about Regina, sort of that wacky, nostalgic look at what Regina is and was. And that'll be premiering the week after.
Oh, yeah, that's part of the show, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, again, at the Mackenzie. Now, this is an interesting exhibition, you know, in terms of ideas, because it's, obviously, I haven't seen it.
Well, yeah, it spans I mean, we've talked about Chris Gurley's photographs about Queen City, right, and how kind of spare and dry and lost our town looks in them. So they'll have photos by Chris Gurley up, but they also have porcelain by Jeannie Ma. You know, and she's got those wonderfully delicate, almost transparent porcelain vessels with her family photographs imprinted on them.
So we're going to see like a range of work that's going to explore like different understandings of what we think Regina is about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, we've got some Jeff Nachtigall's work, and he's kind of like us, you know, middle class and white and young. And then we've got Edward Poitras, who's, you know, First Nations artist who represented Canada at the Venice Biennale, and his work is usually made out of bronze and really big.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So it'll be a really nice... Oh, and Wolf Perot's work, which everyone knows is the back alley pieces.
Yeah.
They're just lovely and evocative.
Okay. Anything else at the Mackenzie, or
is that all happening this week?
We have to talk
about Chester Brown opening
at
the Dunlop.
Yeah, that was going to be my next.
Because another part of Regina is the Louis Riel story.
Exactly, and Chester Brown, a comic artist from Toronto, has made a series of comic books called Louis Riel, and they've all been bound into one single hardcover edition, which is being launched here in Regina. It was already.
There was a book signing on Saturday, but the official launch is going to be at the Sherwood Village branch.
That's right, the Sherwood Village branch of the Dunlop Art Gallery. And it's going to be on this Thursday at 7 o'clock p.m. And that's at 6121 Rochdale Boulevard.
So you just go up to the North Superstore.
Yeah.
And then instead of going to Superstore, you turn left and keep driving until you hit...
until you hit the library. It's on that road.
Yeah.
But it's a really, I mean...
Well, you were describing that his work, he does each panel separately on a tiny piece of like 7.5 by 7.5 watercolor paper.
Yeah.
And then from there, he photocopies them into like the page size.
Right.
So each panel exists on a separate piece of watercolor paper.
Yeah, and this is what you're going to see in the gallery, all the separate panels sort of put together again into the narrative of the comic book. But the comic book itself is just, it's so interesting and it's so relevant to this place and this time that, you know, you can't help but sort of be swallowed up in it and reading about it. There was an article done for the Prairie Dog, this last issue of the Prairie Dog, which featured a discussion between Maggie Siggins, who wrote the Riel book, and...
Well, Chester references her book quite a bit.
Quite
a deal. Because unlike most comic book artists, or maybe like most comic book artists, there's a lot of reference material included in the comic where he's got notes, where he talks about where he's gotten different things and alternate views and, you know, his view on Riel's supposed schizophrenia. And he even talks about, like, his own mother's mental illness. And, like, there's, like, if you could just read those pages, and they're all hand-lettered, there's a lot of great information about Riel in there.
At any rate,
another great gray day.
Yes, and that brings us to the end of our show. So thanks for listening, everyone, and have a good dry weekend.
Bye-bye.
The trouble with an impressionist, he looks at a log. He doesn't know who he is staring at this log. And surrealist memories are too amorphous and proud. While those downtown macho painters are just alcoholic. The trouble with impressionists. That's the trouble with impressionists. That's the trouble with impressionists. That's the trouble with impressionists. trouble with personalities, they're too wrapped up in style. It's too personal, they're in love with their own guile. They're like illegal aliens trying to make a buck. They're driving gypsy cabs, but they're thinking like a truck. There's a trouble with personalities. 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 Like the druggy downtown kids who spray paint walls and trains. I like their lack of training, their primitive technique. I think sometimes it hurts you when you stay too long in school. I think sometimes it hurts you when you're afraid to be called a fool. There's trouble with casters. There's a trouble with casters. There's a trouble with casters. There's a trouble with casters.
This is the Talent Pool on 91.3 FM, CJTR.